Right, how y'all doing today? It's your boy Jermaine from Shovel Nose Hogs back with another video, and I have another special guest with me. We have Eslin from Exotic Fire Hogs, so I'm gonna give it off to him and let him further introduce himself and let us know how he got started not only keeping hog nose snakes but breeding them as well.
Hey, how you guys doing? My name is Eslin Guimaranes. I'm with Exotic Fire Hogs, and it's like almost like everybody else. It was like love at first sight. I used to breed I've been breeding and keeping animals since 96. The most basic animal that could get you into the hobby here in Florida, being a Floridian, is like an iguana, green iguana, which unfortunately is one of the invasives now. But when I first started, that was like, you know, something that everybody achieved to have. And through the years of going through, I don't know, countless reptile shows here in Florida and everything, one day I go to Daytona on 2015, as a matter of fact, and I saw a hognose for the first time. It was at Brentford Gardner's table, and then I went to Travis Whistler's table, and then I spoke to Travis for a little while, and the next thing you know, I went home with 6 hognose. About 25, yeah. Especially that first trip. And then I was done. It was a done deal. And okay. Believe it or not, you know, it was the first animal that got me into everything was a purple line albino superconda. Travis Whistler had one at the table. That was serious.
Did it have like the stripe going down his back?
Yeah. That's it. That's what set it off for me. And my wife, Nicole, was like, I like that one. She was, you know, looking at the one right beside it, which was actually a classic. And the classics look nice. You know, of course, it's basic, but it's still an awesome looking animal. It's everything about hognose is beautiful. But then exotic red color, and, you know, you add all the other colors to it, it just makes it a little bit better. But yeah, that's how I got started. And we started with 5, 2015, beginning of 2015. Well, not to the very end of 2014. And then by the beginning of 2015, we went from 5 animals, which was our initial purchase. And we just went crazy with it, knowing that we have a breeding background and stuff. I saw potential, and not only was there potential as you know, a breeder to be able to grow, but at the same time, it was just so much love for this species, having, you know, access to it and knowing such good people in the industry. It was a recipe to be able to grow, and that's what we did. We grew and started to learn about Exantic, Amory, however you want to pronounce it, or however you want to call it. We started getting into Toffee from Purple Line Albinos. We went to Exantics, Toffees. Then we got into all the pattern morphs like Condas. We got into Jags. We got into Stripes. We got into all that stuff. And slowly but surely, you know, through the years, we became more and more and more diverse, and that's where we're at now.
Okay.
Some people ask me, what makes a powerful collection? You know, I get that question a lot. If you were to start off, what would you start off with? And to be honest with you, we started with high-end animals, but it wasn't because that's what we achieved for. That's just what caught our attention.
Mm-hmm.
You knew about it. We knew how important it was to become diverse. That's where the power is, having a diverse collection. It's not about having 3,000 animals and having all high-end animals. It's having a diversity where you could plug this into that, make that, and then always setting up for the next goal, and, you know, adding another gene to this. And how did this one interact with that gene? You know, like with the Arctic gene, when I first started the Arctic gene, I was like, whoa, that's a beautiful animal. But then a lot of people were having trouble identifying Arctic, so it was hard to sell, or not hard to sell, but market, because a lot of people don't notice the difference. Uh-huh. An orange albino or an Arctic albino, and the price is 3 times the difference. So people were like, well, I don't get it. But then everybody wanted super Arctic, and they couldn't, you know, get to that gene without having the Arctic, because nobody wanted to go that route. And there's several different ways of doing it. I feel like the best way to do it, in my opinion, is always starting at the bottom and working your, you know, way up. And that's what we enjoy doing. That's the process that we enjoy doing. process of elimination, knowing what this does. If it didn't do well, okay, well, we know not to mess with that one no more. Now we add this because of how it interacted with this gene, and that's kind of like how we got started. Just, you know, singling every gene out, knowing how it works on itself, and then being able to put it to work with the stuff that we knew it would mess up.
Okay. So do you think it's important to not only have like low, like you say, you started with high end snakes. Do you think it's important to have for sale like lower end morph, like just like a normal or just an albino in terms of like selling?
Well, that's a trick question in a way. It depends on the person, on the breeder. A lot of people don't feel like they want to waste their time with the lower end stuff because they feel like it's, you know, it's such a high demand that you would be able to move any animal. Personally, the way that I see it myself and what I feel kind of sets me apart a little bit is that there is no hognose too cheap or too expensive to produce. It's more of how can I make this animal better and better and better and better. And then when you make something better than what it was and continue to improve, you're always going to have people that are interested in it because they're going to want to improve in the same fashion that you did. So it's kind of like building blocks, you know? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like putting it together to then later on you look back and you're like, whoa, in the last 3 years I took this from here and now look how far it's gotten. I can't wait to put another gene into this, or I can't wait to go this direction now and take it, you know, take a curve and see where it takes me and stuff like that. But yeah, definitely. Diversity is key in my diversity is key. You don't want to be too heavily invested in all of the high-end stuff because that doesn't necessarily mean if you plug in two high-end animals that you're automatically going to produce high-end animals. A lot of the high-end animals don't really mesh well because you already have too many genes on this one, and then you're kind of like obsolete with certain groups, like, you know, snow supers. Everybody wants snow supers, us included. We should have been able to produce snow supers from the get-go because a lot of our stuff was pretty much possible head and so on. But we didn't go that route. I didn't want to produce supers at first because I didn't want to just make regular snow supers. I wanted to make the best snow supers possible. So we add other genes to the, like, purple line and add, you know, some really nice flashy Xantics that had nice patterns so our snow condos would be nice. And that's kind of like what we were doing. In the beginning, when I first started, we didn't have as many groups as we have now on Facebook. And a lot of people in the industry that were at the forefront, which are still in the forefront now, a lot of those people weren't sharing too much information because they didn't know what was going to happen. A lot of them were unsure themselves. They were just following what they did the year before, and it was successful. So, you know, a lot of people were still trying to figure stuff out. And because I would say probably about 3-4 years ago, if you compare the caliber of animals that are produced now to the caliber of animals that were produced 3-4 years ago, it kind of took a very big leap in the amount of animals that came out. You know, Dan Ebby with Sable, right after the Arctic gene really hit, when they were taking it to Lavender, taking it to Toffee, taking it to stuff that hadn't been produced before. Because like everything else, whenever there's a new gene, the first gene that everybody tries to plug it into is T-negative albino. It's regular albino. And then when you start messing with the other genes, like, oh, we have 5 or 6 different types of caramel albino, and out of those caramel albinos, you have Lavender, you have Evans Hypo, you have Caramel. That So when you take those things, you take those types of genes to those different types of caramel, you know you have a lot to work with. So in the last 3-4 years, I would say that hognose took a huge turn and a lot of groundbreaking, I would say, combinations that have made hognose even more addicting and more dramatic as opposed to a classic. That is the reason why so many people want to get into hognose and so many people want pets. And I think there's a lot of negative, if you would say, because if you speak to somebody that doesn't know hognose or isn't too, I would say, experience with snakes in general, the first thing that they say is like, oh yeah, but they're very picky feeders. And they're not. They're really not. You just got to troubleshoot them. Some of them are better than others to temperature. So if you got an animal that likes it in a certain temperature gradient, you know you need to keep it there. So there's things that people don't realize. And one of the biggest misconceptions that we have as a whole, as you know, a community, is having to be able to teach the people that are getting in that it isn't as difficult. And yes, sometimes they compare hognose prices to, you know, the prices of a corn snake. And you have corn snakes that are under $100. And I understand that some people were shocked when they try to, you know, ask you for a snowconda. And when you tell them that it's still in the thousands, they're like, what? Okay. Uh-huh. You know, and that's normal. But you can't get upset. You just got to educate. That's the problem. Problem is a lot of people don't want to educate because they don't want to waste your time because they feel like if it's not gonna if you're not working towards a sale, then you're wasting your time, and that's not the way it should be. I think that, you know, we should definitely educate. And you're doing that with the YouTube channels, and we have other people working like on YouTube channels too, like Kevin, and everyone's trying to all the groups, you know, you have a lot of people in the groups that do share information. You have a lot of people in the groups that are all for teaching people, and that's what it should be. Because when not that long ago, in reality, considering that it was 2014, we didn't produce our first animals till like 2016. But I made a lot of mistakes going into it. You know, I made a huge, made a huge amount of mistakes. Purchasing adults was a big no-no.
Purchasing. Hey, speak on that a little bit. Yeah. Why was that a mistake?
Well, it was a mistake because, as you well know, imagine now. You know, fast forward all these years. How hard is it for you to find an albino adult female?
Yes.
Because you're putting in a year and a half of feeding. It's not cheap to feed a snake. If you're looking at one snake, it's not that bad. But when you're honestly, you know, you add up everything that it takes to grow a female from 7 grams, and you can get them to like about 180 grams in 13 months, 14 months, doesn't necessarily mean that they're ready to breed, but you're getting an adult that's 75% of the way there. A baby value is at 250, 300, around there, right? For a baby albino. And then the guys are not going to sell it for 600 because people say that, oh, you should double up. No, it's not true. But what happens is that the people that do want to sell them, not because they want to sell it, it's because they're forced to sell it because they're either A, had a lot of problems with them. B, they're not looking into breeding. There's a lot of different variables that go into why somebody would sell an adult. The average person like me that's looking into breeding won't sell adult females. If I'm gonna sell an adult female, it's gonna cost 5-6 times what the actual animal is worth. And that's when you're looking at it from a financial point, it takes you 2-3 times what the animal is worth just to raise it there.
Yeah.
Losing money and time, you're just handing somebody all your money and your time by rehoming it. So if I get rid of an animal, it's going to be because A, it doesn't fit my plans no more. B, because it's unhealthy and I don't want to breed that into my lines because I've taken so many steps forward. I don't want to take another step back. I don't want to hurt, you know, the quality and the quality of my lines. It's just, it takes a lot to have animals that are healthy, you know, and that buying an animal is a huge risk. An adult's a huge risk. Because people that typically sell adults, the reason why they're selling adults is because it's not doing what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
It's got troubles. You know, a lot of animals that have trouble, you know, like a very troubled start that had to be medicated, that had to do all of that. That's all a huge risk at the very end when you go to ask an animal to broodmate, or if you don't broodmate, I don't know, that's another topic. But I broodmate. So you're gonna ask an animal go to broodmation for 3 months at extreme temperatures, which is normal. An average healthy animal would handle that. I believe that in the wild, that's more like natural selection taking its course. You know, that's one way of weeding out all the unhealthy animals in the wild. So
Yep.
an animal in captivity that's most likely already struggled and had I don't know how many, you know, treatments or medication or whatever, to take that leap of faith, 3 months without feeding, you know, living off of its stored body fat, to then later wake up and then double, almost double its weight, produce eggs, and on top of that, double clutch.
That's a lot.
Task. So a lot of people that try to jump the gun and buy adults, they're risking a lot of things. One, the animal most likely had trouble because nobody's going to sell an animal like that unless they're being honest. A lot of people are honest. They will tell you, hey, I bred them a year. I gave her another year. It didn't work out. If you want to try, this is the price. And that's ethical.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's willing to take to roll the dice. You know, here you go. But a lot of people won't do that. They won't say that. They'll just say, ready to breed, virgin, and then you're, you know, buying something for what you feel is going to do what it's supposed to do. And then when you know, you got a loaded gun, and you're like, well, what am I supposed to do at this point? You know, you invested, and then you try, and then unfortunately it doesn't go your way, or sometimes it does go your way. But for me, it didn't go. It didn't go that way. And I invested a lot, and I bought a lot of animals from reputable people, and it went downhill fast. And I, at that time, I didn't have enough experience under my belt for me to be able to troubleshoot certain things. So I'm not entirely blaming it on the quality animals that I had. But for somebody who's starting, I definitely suggest don't purchase adults unless you 110% trust the person. And even then, if you could trust the people that you're buying from, if it's not local and you got a ship, that animal now has to adjust itself to somebody else. Husbandry, light cycles, you know, feeding, the temperature. You know, I keep my animals at a certain temperature. If you keep your animals a little warmer than me, that's kind of like something that they got to adjust. That animal might dehydrate for the first 3-4 months until the body adjusts to what needs to. You know, maybe you don't feed as much as I do, or I don't feed as much as you do. Maybe you push the animal because you're feeding it too much because it's what you're used to. And then the animal is not, you know, the animal isn't hydrated enough to be able to digest as much food as you're giving, as you're offering. It's going to have a problem. Sometimes it'll regurgitate. And sometimes people panic and give medication because of a simple regurgitation. A lot of variables. And that you get that with experience. And that's why it's important for people to explain certain situations. That's why I'm transparent with what I do. I'm transparent because I want people to know, you're at home and you've got two animals and you want to breed, it's possible. It's not easy, but it's possible. If I can do it, I'm sure you can do it and anybody can do it. But you know.
Yeah.
And it's not.
It's not easy. It's a lot of ups and downs. So kind of getting back on the morphs, like you said, in the past 3 years, it's been a big explosion in the different type of morphs and morph combinations. Have you been fortunate enough to produce any world's first, or have you even had the opportunity to introduce a new gene into the market?
Okay, so I haven't introduced anything new to the market. No, I haven't been able to discover anything. What I have done, and I've helped a lot of people understand what they already have in their collection, because a lot of people don't pay attention to detail or fail to see what's in front of them because they're trying to, you know, escalate and jump the gun into something a little bit more obvious. So what I have done, like I said, when I first started was I had a lot of high-end animals. When I would produce animals, I would realize there was so much variability in the same clutch. So I would see what and why. And what that did to me was that allowed me to realize how certain genes, even as simple as the RBE pastel, how would it work? What would it do and stuff like that. So no, I haven't brought anything new to the table. And as far as world's first go, it's never been a goal of mine. It's never been a goal of mine to, you know, aim for world's first. I mean, I tip my hat to those that do, but personally, it's not something that I like to do because I don't feel strongly about breeding siblings. And unfortunately, that's usually what it takes for people to produce a lot of world's first.
Mm-hmm.
I pride myself in having diversity and being able to offer a trouble-free and problem-free animal. So for me, it's never been a race. What I do and what I like to do is take an animal from point A and find out how can I make it better than what everybody already considers this to be. And I feel like that's kind of like what's giving me the upper hand in certain, you know, certain projects to be able to produce such a nice animal as, you know, as opposed to what's already out there, what's known to be out there. So I don't really strive for it. Like, yeah, I have quad heads of a bunch of cool combinations going this year. I lost 21 clutches, unfortunately, to an incubator malfunction, which caused a lot of setback, but there was a lot of cool stuff in there. Possibly, you know, a couple worlds first if it was in my cards. I know I pushed for it, but it's definitely something that I like to do. I like to take, you know, Sable, and instead of making Sunburst right away, if I had Sable, I have a Sunburst Conda. Instead of going right away and trying to make Sunburst Conda, I went ahead and I threw Lavender into it. I throw it to Snow Conda. I throw it to other stuff that has a lot of color, and at the same time added an extra gene. So yeah, I have multiple brown looking animals, but when I have that, I use those females, raise them up 1 year, and then I go ahead and have another backup breeding to produce the counterpart.
Yeah.
I hold back, you know, 4 or 5 of those females, normals, condas, and super condas, because I always like to throw conda to conda if possible.
Yeah.
And I'll go ahead and I'll, you know, raise those girls for a year. Then the following year, I'll go ahead and try to pair another pair to produce a male, so that by the time that male's a year old, the females from the year prior are pretty much ready to go, and then you can go ahead and do a breeding that way. And that's what I've done. That's what I've done from the beginning, and it takes an extra year and a half to do it that way. So I'm always second or third to world's first, but it's cool because at the end of the day, mine look nice, theirs look nice too, and it's not really a race for me. It's never, I enjoy what I do. I seriously enjoy sitting back and looking at my collection. It's a distraction sometimes. You know, it kind of keeps me sane. You know, we all have hectic lives, and there's it's always like that. So for me to go inside my snake room and be able to sit there and look at stuff and enjoy it. And it's funny because my wife is like, she goes in there, she's like, all your stuff is labeled, but if I pull the snake out and I ask you what it is, you know exactly what it is just by looking. Yeah. Don't you? Wouldn't you know?
Yeah, I know all my snakes.
Even know what slot and what rack and what bin.
Yeah.
And that's the type of attention to detail that it takes for us to be successful. That's what it takes. It takes repetition. It takes you having to pay attention to detail, because 9 out of 10 times, if an animal is sick, you need to pick it up before it's actually showing you that it's past the point where you can't correct it anymore.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why it's important for you to interact with your animals and know, okay, this is not normal. You know, oh, it hasn't fed 2 feedings. Maybe I need to look at something. Are your temperatures right? Or, you know, are you using the sense? Because sometimes they go off a feeding just because you change the type of bedding. Some could be, you change bedding and, you know, now they're like throwing a fit. They'll be fine. So you got to pay attention to those types of details. And you only learn that, you pick that up by doing it. There's no
experience.
There's no book that you're going to pick up that's going to tell you that. You're going to talk to people. They're going to explain their situation, their experience. And then you take a little bit from this person, take a little bit from that person, and you put it into what you're looking at and what you're doing day by day. And that's how you progress. That's how I did it. That's how most people do it, because you enjoy what you do. So you don't stress out. You're stressful, but you don't stress out to the point where you want to quit. You just know that, okay, well, by doing it this way and I keep getting these results, then I need to change it around. And don't be afraid to try new things, because I've been proven wrong before, and I've helped other people that have been doing this longer than me figure things out that they didn't think, just because sometimes you get a mental block because of how stressed you can be trying to figure one problem out. And it's literally the answers in front of you. Sometimes it's so simple. And all it takes is for you to look back and get either a breath of fresh air, a new set of eyes that can actually sit there and tell you, well, you know what? I think you're not doing it this way because you're too set on this, or maybe try this. Like, a lot of people in the beginning didn't want to add probiotics sometimes, and it helps a lot of animals. Mm-hmm. We're asking them to do something that they regularly don't.
Yeah.
You're on a sole rodent diet. And in my opinion, I feel like when they have a diverse diet, you know, like frogs and toads, they have toxins. So that's probably a natural method for them to be able to detoxify, and at the same time, they could actually deworm themselves.
Yeah, kill bacteria and parasites.
From sitting in ponds when they're trying to pull the shed out, just because we add clean water and we add a clean, moist spot or humid hide, you think they don't do that in the wild? There's a reason why they gravitate towards it. It just might not be as sanitary as we would hope in the wild. Sometimes it's, you know, a little puddle. That's all they can find. They'll sit there and get a little bit of bacteria or something, and then they have to fight it off with those extreme temperatures. That's one of the reasons why I feel like when you brumate, I think that doesn't only do something to them biologically. Like, it doesn't just make their clock tick and make females and males know that once they wake up, it's time to breed. I think that step away from food allows their system to kind of detoxify from whatever toxins they're picking up from whatever foods and everything. And I think that's kind of like a fresh start. And that's one of the reasons why when you have a picky feeder baby, if you can do like a short brumation, sometimes it just kicks them out. You can try every scent under the sun. And sometimes it's just that one little thing that kicks them back into reality. And they're a snake again, not just a hissy worm. Now they're an actual snake that wants to eat and wants to sleep and wants to drink and wants to grow.
Yeah.
And that's what it takes sometimes. And that's how you learn, by, you know, explaining things to people and you getting their intake or their take on things. And then, you know, you kind of build kind of like a game plan. Okay, how can I attack? Oh, okay, well, last time I did this and it didn't work. Well, I heard this person talking about this one and it worked for them. Maybe let me try and see what I can do. And sometimes when you try those things, it works out. That was one of the issues that I was having in the beginning. Being in Florida, you know how hard it is? It's cool. everything is humid and everything is hot.
Yeah.
In the beginning, I didn't brumate, and I was having slug fest after slug, and it was just stressful.
So how did you know when to pair a male to a female when you weren't brumating?
When I wasn't brumating? When I wasn't brumating in the beginning, I had adult animals. I had adult males. I had adult females. Some adult females that I had purchased from other friends of mine. And one of the issues that I was running into at that point, when I didn't have when I didn't brumate, I wasn't going by shed cycles. Now, people that don't brumate say, you know, you gotta try shed cycles. You gotta try shed cycles, and maybe you can get them to breed that way. Back then, there wasn't a lot of information that people were sharing. Yeah. So I would just try to test the male and a female. If a female twitched, I would go ahead and let them, you know, court. And if they went ahead and they bred, I would try to sit there and see how the female's reaction would be as far as feeding goes and the whole nine. And it worked out maybe 2 out of 10 times. What would happen was I kept getting slugs.
Yeah.
My temperature was warm. My male sperm obviously was cooked. It was fried. They didn't have temperature. They didn't have time to reset themselves. And I was frustrated. I was at the point where I was like, I can't do this anymore. And then I go ahead and I, you know, network. I'm talking to friends locally. And I speak to Jamie Vaughn from JNC Hognose.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Jamie, listen, either I got to come over or you got to come over, because I need help. I really need help. And he, you know, broke it down to me. He's like, man, what you're going through, I went through, and the only thing that I could do is brumate. And I said, you sure? I'm scared of brumate because I'm going to lose my animals, because that's the first thing you read. When you brumate, the first thing you read is people put it in the fridge and they never come out. And they die in brumation because they're too cold or because whatever. A lot of times, those people don't know that their animal is subpar. Their animal is struggling health-wise. Mm-hmm. In brumation, you know, an animal that's probably 30% underweight or dehydrated as it is, and they're already going to dehydrate inside a fridge because that's what happens. Even if you offer water, it just happens. That's part of the process. They lose water weight. They lose that. They dehydrate a little bit. So I told Jamie, I said, Jamie, look, man, I'm having this problem. He walked me through it. That was the first year that I could honestly say I felt like I was doing something right. And then that's when I became an advocate. That's when I said, you know what? I'm going to, whoever I see having problems with, you know, having infertiles and so on and so forth, I'm going to explain it to them. And that's what I did. And everyone that would see, oh, your eggs are beautiful. Oh, you got beautiful big clutches. Oh, what is it that you're doing? I'm just brumating. I'm doing everything before. The only thing that changed was the fact that I had to spend $600 on a new fridge because I didn't want to buy a used one because I didn't want to run the risk, because at that point I already had, you know, 30, 40 animals brumate. I couldn't go the more affordable route because I would have to get too many of them. So I went ahead and I bought a premium fridge that was 12 cubic foot. And I went through the process. I was able to figure it out. And that's what happened. I figured it out.
Okay. And so with that, let's kind of get into, for a beginner that maybe has, let's just say has two snakes, a male and a female. From your experience, what is the most appropriate size and age to start breeding a hognose snake?
Okay. So what I've found has been the most reliable for me is more age than size. So I'm going to give you two exact polar opposites so you can see why I'm saying that. One, you can get a yearling female. I've sold females to friends and I've sold females to regular clients from my clutch mates of mine. In a year, I'm getting photos and they're 270 grams.
Wow.
My females are 150. So that's almost double the size. So if you go by just weight, that female is not ready. She's not mature enough to hold. But my female is 150, 160 grams. She's 6 months away from brumating at 2 years, just shy of 2 years. 2 years is fine to brumate. Then when they come out, they're mature enough. And for those people that haven't brumated, they don't know the difference. But believe it or not, there's a lot of animals that you put into brumation, and the moment that they come out, they look mature. It's something, it's unexplainable. I could explain it to you, but you got to experience it.
You got to see it.
Like their faces, their heads bulk out. They get more of a mature look where it's not like, you know, just a long, lanky snake. They mature. And I feel like maturity is definitely the route to go. So 2 years, you could have girls at 130 grams at 2 years old, or you could have girls that are 350, 400. I've even seen people go up to 500 grams and more. I'm sure there's bigger ones out there. I'm sure there's a bunch of hogzillas out there. But for me, I would say 2 years minimum, and I've done as small as 130 grams pre-breeding, like before breeding. I would do 130 grams, and that was a four-year female. She was 4 years old, and 130 grams. At 2 years old, she was at 130 grams, and she never went a step above. And then I spoke to a couple of friends of mine, and I got a couple, you know, suggestions. And I went ahead and I bred her because she was mature enough already. Mm-hmm. After the videos that I seen, there was a lot of females in the wild that were only 150 grams. And some of them were double clutching already according to the time of year. So I went ahead and I bred her to the Snowconda. Went ahead and I bred her. And she went from 130 grams to 190 grams with the first clutch. And she laid 12 fertile eggs. And I didn't think I was going to get a first fertile clutch. And, you know, she clutched no problem. Doesn't even look that bad. Didn't even look like I thought she was going to look. And she starts to slam food. I'm giving her multivitamin with the feedings. I'm giving her a little bit of dusted calcium for extra calcium. And she goes into her prelay shed for her double. okay, I guess she's gonna double. Lo and behold, she goes through it, she hit another 9x. And perfect. All fertile. Mm-hmm. Look. And then I had females that were 3 years old, 400 grams, and I couldn't even get one fertile egg out of them. They would bug out. And I know that they were bred and everything. So I feel like maturity and body mass, health-wise, it's definitely the way to go.
100%. So you think the leaner females do better than the big?
I can't say for somebody else. I know my males max out between 60 and 90 grams or 100 grams, which is still – 100 gram male is huge. Mm-hmm. 100 gram male is big. And I've had 100 gram males on 300 gram females, 400 gram – 400 gram females is huge. That's not a small hog nose. That's a big girl. And I've had them successfully breed, lock, everything. I've had them either reabsorb, they've laid slugs, or I've gotten maybe 4 or 5 eggs out of 30 eggs, 26 eggs, 28 eggs, and I've only gotten, a handful of fertile eggs. So personally, I think that the ideal weight and the ideal age is minimum about 2 years. And I feel like the sweet spot, I would say, that's what we call the sweet spot, is between 2 years of age and 3 and about 250 grams, 260 grams. Those are the girls that are going to give you, in my opinion, of course, there's many ways of doing it, but in my opinion, I feel like those are the girls that are going to do the best for you. Those are the girls that are going to most likely double, and they're not going to suffer because they're not big, where they're not going to give you a ton of eggs, but at the same time, they're mature enough where they can handle it and they'll bounce back. And if you're feeding good and you're doing everything that you're supposed to do, you're giving them the right amount of water, quality of water is important. You don't want no water that's contaminated. You don't want none of that stuff. You want clean water. And you should be fine. You should be okay with a 200 gram female, 300 gram female in the 2 year range, 3 year range, even 4 year range is perfect. That's what I found that works perfect. And I know people that are breeding 10-year females. They're 10 years old and they're still going. I mean, why not? If they're laying, they're going through the system. They're going through the whole motion like they would. There's no reason not to, Some people feel like, oh, that's an old girl. You need to retire. But if you do retire that girl and you're still feeding her and she's still doing everything she's supposed to, she looks perfectly fine, and she's still going to slug out occasionally because she wants to, there's girls that could pick up the scent of a male in the room, doesn't have to be in the same rack. They're just in the room, and they'll go off a feed. There's girls that would literally go off a feed. Same thing with males. There's males. I have 6-month-old males now, 8-month-old males now, that they can pick up female scent, and they'll go months.
Wow. All right.
They'll just pick up again. And there's no scent that you're going to trick them into eating because their mind is not on eating.
Mm-hmm.
How can I find that female? And they'll surf the cage back and forth, and you'll be like, I don't know what to do because they're losing weight, and of course they're gonna lose weight. Your temperature is still 85 to 90 degrees depending on how hot you keep it, and they're obviously burning body fat because they're trying to find a female, so they're pacing around and they're not eating. They're gonna lose weight, and then all of a sudden, magically, 3 feedings, 4 feedings in, and they look perfectly fine again.
Yeah. All right. So now moving on to the next stage, which is brumation. So what is your brumation temperatures, and how long do you usually keep your snakes brumated?
Okay. So what I like to do, what I feel most comfortable and what I feel is ideal, I usually start the beginning of September. I stop feeding in the beginning of September, the group that I'm going to breed. Females and males alike. I stop feeding them, and then I don't do anything to my temperatures. I just let them empty out for 2 weeks on regular temperature. And that third week, I'll go ahead and I'll turn off and let the heat, I'll let the ambient temperature just be their only heat source. My room temperature is at anywhere between 77 to 78, 79 degrees. That's like as much as it really fluctuates. It doesn't fluctuate too much. Then they sit there for another week. On that third week, the very end of that third week, which is the beginning of the fourth week, they're going into the fridge. What I find more important is keeping it dark. You don't want them to have any light. You want them to sleep and you want them to relax as much as you can, because the more active they are, the less sleeping they do, the more body weight that they're going to burn, and you don't want that. So temperature is important. The lower the temperature, the better. My fridge, I always set it at, the first week that they're in the fridge, I set it at 65. So they're going to go from 75, 77. I'm going to start them off at 65. And every couple days, 2 days, 3 days, I bring the temperature down 3-4 degrees. I know in the wild, they have the temperature gradients and everything is so crazy. But personally, I feel more comfortable doing it this way, because it's been what's worked for me.
Yeah.
I don't feel like it's ideal to just shock them, go from regular temperature straight down to, you know, 55, 50. So I do that drop in temperature. And usually after like 2 weeks, they're down to 55. Then in 55, they stay until January 1st.
Okay.
First, they come out. And if for some reason I can't put them down that early, so I usually want them in for at least 3 months. That's my goal. My goal is 3 months. So if I start a month later, I take them out in February.
And so now that you've had them brumated for 3 months, what is your process of taking them out of brumation? And when do you start feeding them, as well as when do you start pairing the males with the females?
So what I do is, As soon as that final, you know, week comes in, I shut the fridge off completely, and I let it warm up. Usually it won't warm up any more than the ambient temperature, and my ambient temperature in the room where the fridges are is 75. So it'll warm up to 75, and then I'll leave them in there for like 2 days with the fridge completely off, and then I'll take the front. I usually use the hefty bags, the contractor bags in the front to black out. I'll take that out and then let there be light. Once there's light and they figure out the night and day cycle, then I'll go ahead and put them in the following day. I'll put them inside the rack that's still at room temperature. And then I'll bring that up to like 81, 82 degrees. And I'll let them sit there for like about another week. And then I'll offer food. I don't go into just feeding them. Usually they're feeding on small adult mice or medium adult mice before they go into brumation. I don't feed them a big meal as the first meal. I like to feed them either a large fuzzy or a hopper or something. Let them digest that clearly, because usually that first set of bowel movement is pretty nasty. So I like to push them to much more than what they, you know, should. And from what I'm gathering over there, where they're from, they don't really have access to a lot of larger meals at that time of year. It's usually just what's out there, and it's small frogs and stuff that's easy to digest, much more easier than a big mouse. So I let them go through that first meal. Sometimes females won't eat right away, and sometimes males won't eat that right away. Usually that means that they're more interested in breeding than they are in eating. And that's because they already, their biological clock is ticking already. They're already starting the process. For those females and males, usually you don't want to wait too much. I know a lot of people talk about shed cycles, but I pair up those females right away. Every breeding, every female has a male that's intended for that season. So if I notice that she's not eating, and I've already tried two times and they're not eating, usually I'll put that male in with her, and the following day I'll pull him back out, and then I'll try to feed. Usually that gets them going. If they locked, she's going to eat right away. Mm-hmm. And that's a good indicator that your female is taken care of already. So, you know, you can go ahead and start, you know, feeding her after that. A small meal, let her clean her bowels, let her clean her system. Once she's back on track, then I'll go ahead and start feeding you more regularly like you would normally do. And in development, if a female wants to eat, you can go ahead and feed her. You shouldn't have an issue with overfeeding at that point, because whatever you do feed, it's typically going directly toward all the egg development and, you know, all the building of the eggs. And that's a demanding time for them. So if you don't want your people to look, you know, really thin and lethargic, you kind of want to feed as much as you can first 2 weeks of her developing eggs and kind of tone it down a little bit. Even though they're still going to ask you for more, don't give too much, because at that point, their body is mostly eggs. So if you give them a lot of food, they don't have too much space for it. So you can cause them to regurgitate. So I usually just don't feed them too much at that point. I kind of like, you know, give them, I have a heavy hand at the beginning so they can handle it. And then, you know, just feed normal at that point, you know, mild days, 3 days. And then if she wants a little bit more, you can go ahead and, you know, do it a little bit more frequently. But it's pretty obvious when a female's grabbing.
So you don't wait until a pre-ovulation shed to start pairing males. Do any of your females shed before ovulation?
I used to, and a lot of females wouldn't shed for ovulation. I would miss. And that was one of the things that me and Jamie were like, I don't know. I bred her, and I saw them lock, and I never got eggs. And he's like, yeah, that happens sometimes. I said, well, what do you think we should do? I got, you know, 5 girls that did that out of 20. So you're figuring, well, you know, a quarter of my females didn't go. And there's got to be something that we could do to improve those numbers. And then that's when, you know, you stick together with somebody that you trust and you, you know, troubleshoot what's going on. And that's what we would do. What we figured out would work the best, same thing with Mitch Davey, was go ahead and put them down first. If you're going to see that they're not eating and they're not feeding, try to breed. And usually when you breed those females first, it will work out. And that it went from 5 out of 20 down to maybe 2. But then you got 3 more girls to go. So now you figured that problem out. Now you got to figure out why are those 2 girls not going. And they're animals, you know. Mm-hmm. Just you did everything right. And you put a perfectly you know, raised and healthy male with a perfectly raised and perfect healthy female. And they breed. Doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get eggs all the time. It's just normal. It happens.
Sometimes. Yeah, my female didn't have a pre-ovulation shed. So if I would have waited to pair her with the male, I would have missed her ovulation.
Exactly. It happens. That's why I see some people that don't brumate. And it's like, there's so many different ways to skin a cat. So I can't sit there and tell that person, obviously, that is successful, oh, you shouldn't brumate. No. It's more of, what do you feel confident in doing? What have you observed that's giving you the idea or has given you the tip that time to breed? I missed them when I didn't breed. So that wasn't effective for me. And I also feel like it's beneficial to the animals to have that period away from, you know, food and the whole nine. It's just, I noticed animals live a lot longer that way for me. And at the same time, They're ferocious feeding. Their feeding response is second to none when they do that. Before, when I had girls and boys awake all the time, they would take a lot more breaks. Males would take a lot more breaks and everything. Females would take a lot more breaks because, you know, they were just all over the place. And what I do is I like to back up females, because sometimes male A with female B, they don't mesh well. Sometimes females don't like that male. Sometimes the males don't like females. So you have to back up sometimes. And I found that the best thing for me to do is have multiple males with the same genetics for groups, and then go ahead and try, you know, male A and male B for, you know, group of female A, B, and C. And then, you know, you can I would say what you do that way is you make sure that those females have not only one chance, but 2 chances of breeding and being fertile, you know, fertilized. And then that made a huge difference in production for me. And there is a such thing as a dual sire clutch. So you need to be careful when you do that. If an azantic female and you're going to, that isn't having anything, and then you put a male that's a snow, or you put a male that's an albino, you can tell who sired the clutch, but that doesn't necessarily mean that all the babies, or you know, like, because if you breed a Snoke to an Azantic, everything should be Azantic.
Yeah.
But there's been cases where people don't get all Azantics. They get half the clutch normals and half the clutch Azantics. But if that's a pretty simple way of knowing who the sire is. But if you use a male that you could have outcome, you can't guarantee those babies.
Yeah.
So you got to make sure that you think things through when it comes to breeding. It's not putting one and two together. You know, you're going to produce babies. You got to make sure you know what you're doing. And logging everything down is perfect. On my bins, I put everything. I put weight that the females come out, the weight that the males come out, the date that I bred or that I bred together. I do 3 days on, 2 days off. 3 days on, 2 days off. And then at the same time, on the date that I put them on, I make sure that I write male interested in female. The next time that I take them out and I put that male back in, male not interested in female. You know, male A not interested in female. Then you put the male B in there. You put male B in there and you put male B interested. Then you put the date, mm-hmm. take them out, let feed them, put them back, and you put male B not interested in female. That's a good indicator that male A and B already bred females, because usually males don't want to continuously breed a female. Once they lock up once or twice, it's done. They don't even care about the female no more. And that's usually when males get eaten, because now the female's in that, you know, she's in that state of mind where everything is food, because now she needs to eat as much as she can and she has controllable hunger. And then she has a male who's pestering her and back, and then she's like, you know, I got to get rid of him. And I'm hungry.
That's a good observation. I never heard anybody say that. Because that's a big scare for a lot of people, is their male getting eaten. So that could be a reason.
I've paired probably 300 times, and I've only had one male eaten. I've only had one male eaten. And that male that got ate was a virgin female. And she was a phenomenal feeder. Came out of formation. Didn't want to eat. I put the male in there. Male ate. She ate. That following time, that break, the first break, she ate, he ate perfectly fine. Before I put a male in with a female, I always make sure that the female starts to twitch or the male starts to twitch, so they know that it's not food. Because sometimes, you know this, I know this, you open up a bin, they're hungry, and they're shooting out the bin with the mouth. Yeah. Whatever's in their mouth or whatever happens to fall in their mouth or whatever they grab is food. They eat first, ask questions later. So if you're teasing with the male, or you're putting a male in, that female's all the way in the back of the bin, and you just open the bin, crack it, put a male inside so he, you know, element of surprise, the surprise is going to be yours. Because coming at him with the mouth open and she sees a third of his body only, she's going to grab that, she's going to take it down, and then you're going to be left without a male. She had a good meal. Hopefully she digested. Sometimes they don't even digest it. They just regurgitate it because it's too much for them. And they'll just regurg. So you got to pay attention. There's a lot of things. There's a lot of reasons why a lot of people are afraid. And I get it. I was there too in the beginning when I didn't have half the that I have now. But there's a lot of mistakes that people can't make. And one of the biggest mistakes is that when they pair up a male, they don't know. And they don't let the female know that the male's in there for breeding purposes. Or even just letting her know there's something in her cage. You don't throw a female in a male's cage. You throw the males in the female's cage. And the reason for that, too, is because she's marking territory. I don't know if you noticed that, but when females are ready to breed, they'll start to crawl on the perimeter of the cage. And you'll notice in the bin that they're riding the sides of the bins.
Mm-hmm.
You throw a male in there, they'll start to wag their tail and flash it everywhere. And usually that's how they let the male know that there's a female around and they're interested in breeding. Doesn't always have to be with the twitch, which is cool. It's awesome. But it's not always with the twitch stuff. It's just there's different markers. There's different ways of females signaling to the male it's time to go or get out of here because I'm not interested. So you got to be the better half there. You know, you got to understand, is it time for me to leave the male or should I not try now and just move on and let her go a couple more days and then try? You know,
okay.
Better judgment. And that's why paying attention to detail is so important. If you don't pay attention to detail, you're going to take a couple hard lessons. You just got to watch and observe and take your action and understand what they're telling you, because if you don't, it's tough because not only are some of these investment animals expensive, but it's a lot of unique animals. You grow, they grow on you. You're attached to them. We name them, we feed them. We know how they are. We know sometimes certain animals only feed a certain way. They don't like it. They don't like you to rub the mouse on their face. They like you just to put it in the area close to their face. You know, so there's little things that you learn on these animals and you get attached to them for you to lose it over something that you feel could have been avoided. That's why it's important to get the details. You know, you build some experience, know-how on how to do things. And again, that's why it's important for people to share information. Sometimes information, not every little bit of information you give is going to help somebody. But if it does help one person, that's awesome. That's awesome.
All right. So now that your female and your male successfully bred, you've noticed that she started building eggs. She's swole. Now she's had her pre-lay shed. And now you're getting prepared for that. About how long do you usually see your females go from pre-lay shed to actually laying eggs? And then in terms of preparing for that, do you use a lay box? And if you do, what kind of substrate do you use?
Okay. So when I notice that the male and the female are obviously not interested in each other anymore, that's one of the notches that I from that point where she's usually going into pre-lay shed, it's about 6 weeks. From the moment that they go into pre-lay shed, it takes them, and I've had them go as soon as 4 days, 5 days on the first clutch, and I've had them go as far as 18 days, 19 days. And it doesn't necessarily mean that because one girl lays 4 days before and another girl lays 18 days later, that the girl that laid 18 days wasn't prepared or it's different. It's just certain girls hold on to it differently. And that's because they don't all, in my opinion, they don't all develop eggs at the same rate. And sizes of clutches has a lot to do with it too. You know, some girls have 8, 10 eggs, 12 eggs on average. Some girls lay 24 eggs on average, 26 eggs. So there's a lot of variables. So if you have a healthy animal, and you notice the pre-lay shed, as soon as she's done shedding, you should get, on average, 7 to 10 days is usual time frame. It's okay to go, you know, a couple days after, even a couple days before. What I have noticed is that some of the girls that lay towards the very, like on the 20th days or 18 days or anything like that, their eggs tend to hatch sooner. That's why some people say, oh, my eggs hatched early. They hatched that 49 days. Yeah. How many days did it take your girl to lay from the moment she had her ovulation?
Yeah.
How many days did it take? Did it take her 10 days like it normally does, or did it take her closer to 20 days? So those are the details that I look at, and those are the things that I document for me to know. You know, so if a girl lays 5 days, 6 days, you already know that. If you're incubating at let's say 82, 83, which is the common temperature that people incubate, you're looking at 56 days, 55 days around there. If a girl lays a lot later, you're looking at 51 days, 50 days, 51 days. I incubate on average on 78, 79.
Okay, so you go on a lower end.
I do it a little lower because I like the babies to be nice and developed. I don't like to rush them. A lot of people rush because they want the babies to hatch faster, because the faster they can feed them, the faster they can move them. I like animals to be healthy. I like them to be nice and fully developed. So my babies can be 5 grams all the way up to 9 grams, 8 grams, 9 grams. And sometimes babies, because females lay smaller eggs, you get smaller babies. But some people rush it, you know, 84, 83, and they're hatching babies at 50 days. But their 50-day babies are 4 grams, 5 grams. Is a big baby for some of those people. I've received some of those babies before. They're like a month old, month and a half old, and they're only 6 grams. And I'm like, Jesus, I'm hatching babies bigger than this. How can this be, you know, a 5-6 week old baby already? You know, how can this have 5-6 meals?
So you were mentioning that you breed on a lower end temperature range that most people do, so you can have more well-developed hognose snakes. So now let's say that you've had a successful incubation and your babies start pipping out and they start hatching. One of the questions I'm sure you've gotten plenty of times is, I have a baby hognose and it's not eating. What are some of your strategies that you use to get a picky eater to start eating?
Well, the first thing that I always ask is, what's your temperature like? What size, what's the size enclosure are you keeping? What substrate? Believe it or not, a lot of these people don't know. And the first option is usually a 10-gallon aquarium. And a 10-gallon aquarium might seem suitable for most species, but when it comes to hognose babies, it's not ideal. There's too much open space. And you know that they're already naturally dramatic, so that means that they stress easily. They figure, and at that size, they think everything's gonna eat them. So what should you do? What first thing that you should do is try to find something that's a little bit more opaque, so you can black out the sides, black out the back. You can do a lot of different things that would get the animal eating. So I don't always resort to scenting first. I don't think that scenting is always, you know, the go-to. Yeah, you might get the animal to eat one time, but that doesn't change the fact that he's still stressed out or she's still stressed out about everything else that's going on. Like, yeah, you got to get animal to a certain size in order for that animal to feel confident enough to be able to live in a space that big or in that environment where, you know, most people have pets. You have a cat, you have a dog. When you're at work, you don't know how many times that dog or cat is pacing around that cage or around that aquarium. There's a lot of movement, fast movements going on. If it's by a window, sometimes birds come by. They feel like, you know, and naturally a bird can't eat a baby hognose. So, you know, they'll be afraid of certain things. So what I do with I have a lot of first time, you know, pet owners, a lot of first time snake owners, you know, because they saw us share pictures or your photos or JMG or from anybody, and they fell in love with an animal and they want to own a hognose. It's a lot of people's dreams. If it's in a legal state, I have no problem helping you. You know, I don't have a problem. So I'll tell them, you know, 6-quart bin is usually a good starting point. The Sterlites will have purple latches. That's ideal. You know, it doesn't take a lot. You could just drill holes. If you don't have a drill because you're not that good with your hands, or you're not into any, you know, carpentry or anything like that, or you don't have a father or mother that can help you, that's fine. You can get a soldering iron. Walmart, it's like $9. Just put some holes in there. Some ventilation is needed. The more the better. And, you know, just a little bit of aspirin. I have basically like a checklist that I do to everyone. I have a little price point chart. And most of these things you can get delivered to your home. You can order it off of Amazon. You know, there's thermostats that already have their heating element or heating pad. There's, you know, aspirin you can get on there. You can get everything in just a couple days. I make sure that everybody has that before I ship out any animal, especially first time. Of course, you know, if you purchase something from me, I don't have to worry about it because I'm sure you know what you're doing. But for somebody who doesn't know, I make sure, you know, that I ask questions without being rude. You know, I ask questions, you know, like, have you ever had a snake before? You know, can I help you? Make sure that, you know, you make yourself available to help ask questions. A lot of people don't like to ask questions because they don't like to sound dumb. Mm-hmm. And that's wrong.
It's no dumb question.
There isn't. I'd rather you ask me that I've already gone through all the headaches and all the hassle, and I could just give you a fail-proof plan and just tell you, here you go. This is what you need in this list. Purchase it. When you have it purchased, you could call me. You could message me. Some people don't like to talk on the phone nowadays, so text. You could text me. That's fine. I'm available. Everyone knows I'm available at whatever time. You have an issue, and if I'm awake, I don't have a problem helping you. So I'll go ahead and tell you, you know, this is how you set it up. This is how you need to do it. And most people get their animal from a $10 aquarium that they purchase at the store with those regular, you know, like the classic setup with aspirin, those regular water dishes, and just one little hide, that one little wooden hide that you find everywhere. That's it. And I'm like, that's too bare.
Yeah.
Too plain. and it's not gonna work. A lot of times they don't even have an under tank, like a basic, you know, under tank heater or anything, or not even a thermostat. They just have a light, basking light, 80 mm-hmm. watt basking light, 100 watt basking light, and they're cooking the poor snake. It's dry. And then, you know, you tell them, listen, it's not that complicated. It's fairly simple. Keeping the hognose alive is fairly simple. Keeping it happy is simple. You just need to make sure that you don't think like a human and you think like a hognose. What would make a baby snake that has no, it doesn't know, it just thinks that everyone's a predator, how can you make that animal happy? Give it a smaller confined space. Doesn't always have to be like that. This could vary by animal. You know, each animal is different. Some of them are very, you know, outgoing, and then others are more, you know, stressed and stress easily. So this works, you know, six quart tub, you know, a nice little layer, about inch and a half of substrate, nice water dish, a moist hide or damp hide, and then a hide that's in the hot spot so they can thermoregulate, but at the same time still hide, so they don't have to worry, because they don't like to be exposed too much.
Yeah.
So, and those little differences, $30, $35 difference, as opposed to $150 for one of those 10-gallon aquarium setups, sometimes they spend more money on the setup than they do on the snake. And then they end up resorting to, you know, $30 setup because
it works.
The way that it goes, it works. It's what you want. You want a happy snake? I want a happy snake. Mm-hmm. I want you to have a happy snake. Because if your snake's happy, you're happy, I'm happy. You know, we're all happy. So sometimes people need to, they need to get a different perspective, you know, because a lot of times they think bigger is better. I've had people buy a 6 gram, 10 gram baby, you know, and they want to put it in a 55 gallon because they have a spare 55 gallon in their backyard. It's been there forever. But that's not ideal. Maybe when it's older, but right mm-hmm. now, no, you got to take steps and step it up. Then once it's, you know, a lot more secure, it's a much more confident animal. It knows that everything that, you know, walks by is not going to kill them. Maybe it's food. Then they'll be much happier, and they would handle that. So, like I said, it's just paying attention to what the animal is telling you, without it having to tell you. You know, just make sure you're there and you pay attention. A lot of people don't understand that, and once it starts to click, they pick up on it, and then they're golden. They're good after that, and then there's the people that will later on see somebody else that was in their shoes, where they were in their shoes.
Yeah, and it'll help them.
Educate them and tell them, yeah, you know what? Maybe you got to bring it down a little bit. Maybe you need to change the temperature, change where your heat source is coming from. Instead of from up above, try it on the tank heater and do this and do that. And that's the beauty of it. See, when I see people asking questions a week ago and they figured it out, and then they see somebody else 2 weeks later and they're the ones giving advice, that means that what we told them worked, and they're confident enough to be able to give somebody else pointers. Mm-hmm. And that to me isn't competition. Like, oh, this one's eventually going to take business. No, there is no such thing as competition.
Exactly.
The more we grow as a whole, the better
for everybody.
The better it is for everyone. That's why I'm not racing for a world's first. I don't want that title. To me, it's not about making it to the top. To me, it's about helping everybody grow there and get there.
Yeah.
You know, once you're at the top and you're looking down, what good is it? What good? No, but you did it by yourself. That's it. But as everyone grows together and we all learn to do things differently and better, the animals are the ones that end up benefiting the most, because there's no race. There's no race. At least to me, there's no race. Okay. But yeah.
All right. So to kind of conclude this video, I want to kind of I want you to discuss some of the projects that you're most excited about, whether it's this year or next year. But I picked out three hognose snakes from your Instagram page that just kind of stand out to me. So I'm going to bring them up on the screen, and I want you to kind of give an explanation about them, and maybe what do you plan on pairing with them. So I'm going to share this first one. All right, so this one right here, you had labeled an extreme red purple albino male. Yes. So this, the colors of this is mind boggling. What are your plans for this guy right here?
So I did three things with him. I did three things with him. I took him to a Zantic, Purple Line of Zantic. I would love to see more of that saturated pink and less gray on an adult snow. I took it to Sable, and I made double heads because I really love the classic, the old Dedrick line, Purple Line albino stuff that Dan Ebby put into some of his Sable stuff. That really nice ruby red sunburst stuff that he has is amazing. I would like to have some of that incorporated into that. And believe it or not, I put that into lavender because okay. I enjoy corals. And in the beginning, the first few corals that I made, they did lose a lot of the pink. And that was because it didn't really have a lot of purple line. And the reason why it didn't have purple line is because in the beginning, a lot of the lavender stuff that was out, it was so inbred that you produce a lot of weak babies. So I had to take that lavender line and outcross it, you know, two generations to be able to get really nice and strong lavenders to the point where I was able to go ahead and make nice lavenders that were healthy. And then he went to one of those lavenders.
Okay. So now I'm going to bring up another one. And this one right here, definitely something I hopefully can produce one day. And this is your RBE Pastel Sable Superconda. So what are your plans with this one? Is this a male or a female?
That's a male. Yeah. That male came to me from Andrew Sparks. And I purchased that. Actually, I traded Andrew for that male. The goal behind that male is taking RBE Pastel, Sable, and the Toffee and making Mai Tais, but also adding Arctic to that. And I also wanted to add a Zantic to that. So that was that goal. Have you seen RBE Pastel Zantics? They're very nice.
No, I haven't. And so explain what that gene is, the RBE Pastel.
RBE is
for those who don't know.
Okay. There's different, I would say there is no super form. So it's a dominant form. You have to breed RBE to something in order to get RBE. But when you breed RBE and you breed it to more RBEs, it gets nicer. But there isn't really a super form because you could take that really nice RBE and breed it to a normal and still not get RBEs. So it
basically lightens the animal up. Because a sable is usually dark, but when you add that in, it lightens it up.
Yes. What that does is more like an enhancer gene.
Yeah, enhancer.
Pastel, because that's what the pastel was in ball pythons. That's what the pastel does in a lot of other genes. And it does look pastel. It does look pastel. But when you breed other genes into the pastel or the pastel into other genes, it enhances the color. It brings out what the actual gene does. So with Sable, it enhances all the nice coloring that you get on the cheeks. It enhances the scales. That's why the animal looks like the scales are very defined. On the top, it gives it like a orange, greenish, peach hue. On the top, it cleans it. And the belly on RBE pastels is also very translucent looking. Like it has a lot of that sheen. It's really nice. And sometimes it even, what it would do is that it would make the belly scales like caramel. Have you seen the caramel belly?
Yeah,
it does that sometimes. Doesn't always do that, but on the more obvious and dramatic RBEs, you could see that.
Okay, and so now I'm gonna bring up the last snake, and this is the one I featured this on one of my videos, and I was pretty blown away when I saw it. Right here, the Toxic Superconda.
Yes. So Toxic Superconda, what I did with that, we produced that animal. And we went and a lot of the combinations that we produce, we make the recipe to make those animals ourselves. So I took a very dark Zantic line and I took a very light toffee line and I made double heads. Then I took that dark male again and I brought it to a different line that was a little bit darker. And that's where I discovered that that darker line had a little bit of RBE inside. And then I bred those. I made them female from the first batch, and then I made males from the second batch. I bred those heads together, and believe it or not, I got twins. That animal was a twin.
Wow.
And we produced two of them in the same clutch, and I got some toxic condors too. And those animals were exceptional. They were spectacular. At that time, they had only Brett Bumgarner had produced Toxic Super. I did it basically a couple months right after he did. So he did the world's first. Like I said, I always come second. Mm-hmm. But it's cool because I like it. It's not like it's a race, but it's fun, mm-hmm. you know? Because then you're like, oh, that's kind of like what I pictured it to look like. And then when you produce your own, you're like, oh, okay, well, that one has this and this one has this, but that one has that. And then, you know, you reach out like, hey, what'd you make that with? Because I see that yours looks like this and mine looks like this. And then you're like, oh, okay, well, maybe I should add a little bit of that to make it look more like this. And but yeah, that's a toxics are beautiful. They're beautiful. They're amazing. So imagine adding Sable to a toxic.
Yeah.
Imagine adding, we haven't seen it yet, but you have Sable Lavender. Sable Lavender is something that we're working towards. We have the Catalaja, which is what Philippe produced, which is the lavender frosted.
Yep. And it has like a reduced head pattern as well. Correct. From the pictures I've seen.
Lavender caramels are amazing too. Those are all things that we're going to hopefully produce in 2022. We have a lot of that stuff going this 2022. And same thing with the leucistic. A lot of people feel like leucistic gene is a dead end. It's not. It's not. Look what JMG did. He did zombie, what I call a zombie snake. He did all
super arctic
eyes. And that's because he had super arctic, which arctic genes already influence the eyes. If you saw my Arctic Frosted Conda, he has black eyes. They get black eyes because the Arctic gene does that. It's a very unique gene. So imagine, he did double dose of the Arctic, so he made a super Arctic, and then he bred that with the leucistic, and he ended up getting super Arctic Lucy, which is an all-white snake with black eyes. He didn't do it with those intentions. I think I overheard or I must have watched something where he was saying that he was hoping that it was going to do something to the pattern. But I don't necessarily think that that would be possible because the way that the leucistic develops, it doesn't look like there's something that could actually grow above it. It's more like there's probably color and pattern underneath it, but then there's like a gene that overpowers everything. Mm-hmm. And it grows because the belly on the leucistics when they're young is clear. It's like a caramel gene, exactly like the caramel belly. And then as the animal gets older, it starts to turn more white. And then the bottom right now on mine are all white. But in the beginning, they were all pink. And it had like that stripe down the middle. And I paid attention to that. And I saw it as it got older, the whiter kept creeping from the top and it just wrapped the snake. So I don't think that, I might be wrong, but my opinion is that I don't think that you would be able to change anything. But then you have stuff that comes out of Brett Bumgarner stuff. Like he has.
Oh, his stuff is crazy.
That comes out of that original line. And then you're like, wow, that's crazy. Maybe there is something that could affect that. You know, maybe it's not just paradoxing. And I'm sure he's working on that. Hopefully he discovers something because I think there's still so much to be done with hognose. And I know that as an industry, the first thing that everything is compared to when it's on the rise is ball pythons. I don't think there could ever be another species that could top it like a ball python did. Because when the ball python fever came, there was people that were literally selling their homes to be able to buy investment. And I don't think that we're, in this day and age, I don't think something like that is going to happen. But there's definitely a lot of room for growth. And it's not about having 5, 6, 7, 10 gene animals. Our future is through education, educating. Yeah. And as you know, I know too, I started with 1, went to 5, and then from 5, it jumped to 10. And then I say, you know, you're looking at a rack. And then you went from 1 rack, like me now, I don't even count snakes no more. You can tell me, if I'll give you $1 million if you tell me exactly how many snakes you got. I won't be able to win that because I don't know. I know how many racks I got, but I don't know how many snakes I got. But like again, that's where the future is. The future of this industry and how we're going to continue to grow and we're going to be able to grow as a whole is educating. And those people that start with one snake just because they want a normal and they don't want to go above it, you can't, you know, talk down on them because that's a low sale or whatever. That's a potential person that's going to help us grow.
Yeah.
And that's the next top five breeder in the world. And you got to treat them as the future because it's our future. That's how we're going to grow. And we won't get far if we think that, you know, there's no such thing, you know, as that there's no beauty in normal and there's no beauty in classics. There is. Of course there is. That's
where everything starts.
How we got here. That's exactly how we got here. So, yeah, personally, I think that there's definitely still a whole lot of growing to do. For everyone, not just for us, not just for breeders, but for keepers and a lot of information, useful information that can be shared and through YouTube channels like yours, other YouTube channels. And if somebody's willing to learn, there's a lot of information out there. You know, the best thing that I could give, the best advice that I could give somebody who's looking to start is try to find somebody who's successful, that's in your same state, and try to mimic or try to get information and pointers from them so that you could learn. Because what works for us in Florida does not work or may not work for people up north and others. We have different set of obstacles here.
Yeah.
And I learned that firsthand. So when people come to give me advice or ask me for advice, the best advice that I could give them is, where are you from? You know, where exactly where? And what are your obstacles? What are your set of obstacles? Like, are you having trouble heating? Are you having trouble keeping humidity? Are you having, because a lot of people have trouble keeping humidity and then we have trouble keeping humidity down.
Yeah.
And so there's different things that we got to work out. But if you understand hominoes in general, then you could always give, you know, help. You can.
Okay. All right. So to conclude this interview, if somebody was interested in reaching out to you or finding or wanted to buy a snake from you, where can they find you?
We're pretty active. So Facebook, we're constantly on Facebook. Instagram, we're constantly on Instagram. You know, we can't sell animals on Facebook or Instagram. Mm-hmm. But you could message us for any information. I can give you emails like snhumeranis@yahoo.com, exoticfirehogs@gmail.com. There's different sources of ways to contact us, and we'll gladly help.
You also offer some animals on Morph Market as well.
Yeah, we do offer. I mean, what happens with us is that we get a lot of repeat customers, so we don't typically have. I don't produce a lot of animals, and I don't buy and sell. So I only sell what I produce, and that's it. So if I have a season like this one where, you know, it's low yield, I'm not going to be as active because I still have waiting lists. I still have people that are interested in animals. So it's kind of like not first come, first serve. You know, you kind of have, you know, a waiting list, and you go down the list. And if later on, you know, those people had already found something better or something somewhere else, then, yeah, you make it to Morph Market and stuff like that. But like I said, you can message us if you just have questions. If you're just trying to figure something out and you don't know how to figure it out, that's no problem. Just message us and we'll gladly help. And if we don't know how to help, we could use one of our platforms to help people or to ask others to see if anybody else has gone through it. And hopefully we could, you know, figure it out.
All right. And so, like I said, I'm going to have all your information in the description. I'll have a link to your Facebook group, your Instagram page, because you take some beautiful pictures and you're consistent at it, which is really cool. And that, I can tell you, that helped me with like trying to figure out what snakes that I want to produce and everything. So that's definitely been an asset to this community. And I appreciate you for joining. You've given us a lot of great information. So if you like this channel, you like this information, feel free to subscribe to the channel. You can like this video. You can leave a comment below, and we'll see you for the next video.